Meeting to order. I would say, first of all, good afternoon, colleagues, and welcome to those of you in the audience. We hope today's program, and we'll call it a program, will be helpful. With that in mind, then, we'll begin with the community college presentation, and we'll come on up and introduce yourselves, and we'll get started.
Chair Blackman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. And I have with me today Cam Preuss-Brawley, who's the Commissioner for Community Colleges. And next to her, Gretchen Schutte, who's the President of Schmeketa Community College. And we have a presentation for you today about community colleges, some background information on the types of students we serve, the programs that we offer, and some other information about community colleges. So with that, I will turn it over to Cam, who's going to start the presentation.
Good afternoon. Chair Backlund, members of the committee, for the record, Cam Preuss-Brawley, Commissioner for the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. We're going to start, I'm going to cover a handful of slides here that give you sort of the broadest overview. There are 17 community colleges in Oregon. We cover all but a portions of eight counties in the state. This slide shows you the boxes where the, if you would, the home office of each of the 17 colleges are, but there are many outreach centers across the state. A picture of who is served by community colleges. We have reached over the 400,000 students a year level as of 2002. Our average age has dropped. It was 37, now it's 36. As you can see, a majority proportion of that service does go to women, and we think that in the next slide, community colleges are the largest provider of post-secondary education services to Oregon's ethnic minorities, and you can see there the percentage that we serve, and that's almost 50,000 of the students that community college serve. I'm going to talk a little bit about community college enrollment.
Excuse me, Cam. Yeah. The last slide, the largest provider of college education to Oregon's ethnic minorities, I presume that's growing. It's not static, I would guess.
Well, just from Schmeketa's perspective, that's among our largest population growing at Schmeketa Community College and really exceeding the proportion in our district.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I would guess that. Yes, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question along the same lines as to how that compares with the demographic percentages statewide. You alluded to it, Gretchen, in regard here to Schmeketa. Does anybody know how that compares to the state demographics per category in total?
Chair Backlund, Representative Hobson, I don't have it front and center in my mind, but I can certainly get that information to you. I would say that, by and large, each of the minority categories are served at approximately their their proportion.
Yeah.
Probably with the exception of Hispanic Americans, because that that group is growing very fast, and we are also, our service level is to that group is also growing, but I can't say to you with confidence that they are equal, but I will certainly return with that information.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we're stuck on the average age of 36 decreasing from 37, is that due to more younger students who are transferring, or do you have a feel for what's causing that decrease in age?
Chair Backlund, Representative Hobson, I would say it's a little early to say definitively, but we are seeing an increase of freshmen right out of high school, and that is, we're seeing a larger proportion of lower division and transfer students. That proportion of the students that are enrolled in that particular set of programs is growing, but I can't yet attribute it only to that.
Could I just add to that?
Please.
Just from the most recent enrollment figures for fall term, we had increase in both lower division transfer and in professional technical programs, even though overall our FTE was fairly flat because of the course reductions and program reductions that we had had to make. So I think some of the answer to your question will reflect multiple things. Certainly one aspect will be the choices that community colleges are making in the resource situation.
Okay.
Okay, now back to enrollment. I just wanted to use this slide to point out the ever-increasing enrollment in community colleges. We have noted about a 5% increase in enrollment each year. We figure about 80,000 students since the beginning of the 1990s have availed themselves to community college services. And the And this slide around about community college programs gives you one picture how students are choosing or what students are choosing as far as programs are concerned. You'll see lower division transfer programs are at about 40%. That's up a bit from last biennium. Professional technical programs at 33%. That's holding steady. Adult basic skills at 18. That's down just a little. And then we have hobby and recreation and self-improvement courses. So that makes up the 100% of service to Oregon's community college population.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Dole.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. What would be an example of a lower division transfer to a community college?
Chair Backlund, Representative Dalton, that is a student who is preparing to transfer on to a four-year university. So, and we have in Oregon something that's called the Associate of Arts Transfer Degree, Oregon Transfer Degree, and it transfers in block those credits to the university, and they are all accepted, and the student enters the university as a junior.
Thank you.
Cam, what would be, I may know the answer, but I may not, the adult basic skills, what would be examples of those?
Representative Backlund, Chair Backlund, I'm sorry. Adult basic skills are basic and intermediate literacy skills, English as a second language, also GED, and programs of that nature. They are there for students who come to the community college who are not ready for collegiate work. And so these are what you might call pre-collegiate. They are to help students to ensure that when they enter a collegiate or a lower division or a professional technical program, that they are adequately skilled to be successful there.
Good.
And with that, I'll turn it over to Gretchen.
Thank you, Chair Backlund and members of the committee. It's just a pleasure to be here to talk about Oregon Community Colleges and also about Chemeketa Community College here and there. And when I talk about Chemeketa, I always like to begin by saying community is our middle name. Chemeketa Community College and Oregon's community colleges are comprehensive community colleges by charter, and I think that's important also to begin with, that we serve multiple community needs, and that's what I get to talk about in this part of the presentation. And certainly we have had experience to know that community wants and needs us to allocate resources to multiple aspects of our comprehensive mission, so we do have diverse programs, and again, that's what I get to talk a little bit about. But I also like to always include that it is the diverse people that we serve that are really at the heart of our mission, not the program so much, but the people that we serve. And the commissioner has talked about the people, their ethnic diversity, their age, and their gender mix, but it is each individual and business client that we really focus on and what we come to work every morning to serve. So yes, access to higher education and workforce training, what's good for the economy, but what is also good for the individual students. And I think uniquely focused in Oregon public higher education, community colleges have that unrelenting focus on teaching and student support. And that's so important when nearly, or I'm not sure what the exact figure is statewide, but 90% or more of our students work part-time and full-time while going to school, so it's very important to be focused on the students. What you see in this slide is that lower division transfer FTE, and as Commissioner Price-Brawley has just elaborated, those are courses that parallel those that are offered at the first 2 years of a four-year school, and we have worked very hard in community colleges to align those programs and so that the preparation ensures that students are as well or in many cases better prepared for the programs that they will see as a junior or a senior at four-year colleges and universities. So our students are supremely accessible, and we have the data to show that. We really are working hard to provide quality stepping stones for students who transfer either at the end of 2 years with a degree or in many cases prior to completing a degree. The next slide shows also that we have a significant FTE in the superb education and experience that we provide for students who are seeking jobs in diverse fields. We have certificates and degrees in areas suggested by the slide, nursing, computer technology, automotive technology, but also many other arenas and changing arenas as the community colleges try to be flexible and adapt to the changing job market. So this work that is nearly 40% of our student FTE and the partnerships that we have with employers and really also a partnership with students who are seeking work has really strengthened every community in Oregon. If you've been to the hospital lately in the Salem area, you've probably been served by one of our graduates. If you've taken your car to be maintained here in Salem, you've probably been served in one of our graduates, but by one of our graduates, but also throughout Marion Polk and Yamhill County. So we really train Oregonians for jobs from high tech to agriculture.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you. Are you seeing any trends, given sort of our economic struggles over the past few years, are you seeing any trends sort of developing as you are preparing students for professional jobs?
Thank you, Representative Dalton, for that question. I think we are seeing some trends. We continue to see an increasing need for training in technology of all sorts that really underlies success in very diverse fields, again, from automotive maintenance, where you have to have high skills in technology, to more of the strictly computer, high-tech, electronics skills. So I think that is a clear trend. But we also are seeing changes in what are the specific skills that students need, and that's why our ongoing training for people who are already employed is a very important part of our mission, to stay in contact so people have lifelong opportunities to get the next skills that are needed as those skills change.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you seeing folks coming in more and more to maybe consider another career, sort of folks in already out in their professional years, and maybe the economy is changing, so they're thinking about a different career?
Representative Dalto and other members of the committee, that is an extremely important role that, again, we uniquely play, and I think our average age reflects that people are coming back for new skills and different skills. We have students who come with a four-year degree, master's degree, PhD, in order to get specific skills to meet the needs and to meet their changing interests as well.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Adult basic skills. Here, again, I would say if we didn't do this work, it wouldn't get done. We definitely provide a leg up for individuals who seek and need basic education, and every completer in these programs is really one more building block for the region and for the state as a whole, one more individual that has the basic education to contribute and give back to the community. And the 8% of student FTE that is in self-improvement, it is in this area that we really provide workforce development and ensure that current and future employees, as I've suggested, really have the competencies and skills that employers need to maintain their high performance in a real competitive marketplace. So we work many times in partnership with others in the community. We support economic development in this way and really work with civic and business communities and community leaders to serve as a trainer, to serve as a technical resource in many cases, and to work as an advisor for very diverse community building initiatives in this arena of self-improvement. And then finally, we provide a small amount of community education in the arena of hobby and recreation through courses that are supported by tuition and fees. I do want to mention that through community education, but also through many of our self-improvement offerings, we really enhance the quality of the community, of course, but we also provide a window into the other opportunities that community colleges have. Many people take a class and then begin to recognize and see what else is possible in education and training at the college, and that's important particularly for students who are really wary of their own potential as a student. We recently looked at some of the data for Chemeketa Community College and saw that one in four who begin with such a course continue either in a professional, technical, or lower division transfer or some other program at the college. We wanted to mention a couple of the specific arenas where community colleges are working hard. We've had a statewide target of increasing the number of high school students in college credit courses while they're in high school. For example, at Chemeketa, we had over 5,000 high school students earn dual credit in a single year, and we've worked hard to increase that number. That figure, I think, is for 01-02, and that was about a 63% or 4% increase from 5 years before that. So we work hard to continue to be a primary college of choice for Oregon's high school graduates. We also have had a goal to increase subsequent enrollment in Oregon University System universities. We've done that through working to have a clear and consistent transfer arrangements with our four-year colleges and universities. We've hired on those articulation agreements. Again, to be specific about Chemeketa, we have five university partners with a physical presence on the Salem campus, and I hope more to come so that people in our local community can continue on to a four-year public university. Another aspect of this, with a statewide, but also Chemeketa has a particular commitment to distance delivery. We offered last year courses through distance delivery to over 15,000 students, and again contributing to our local community folks' ability to subsequently enroll at OUS or to just work on particular courses or strengths or skills. And this distance delivery method, I think, really recognizes the family and work commitments of many Oregonians. On the next slide, I wanted to, although I've alluded to our contributions to economic recovery and development through our work with Oregon employers, I think you can see in this slide, just in a few bullets, the kind of work we do that does contribute. The rapid training courses, training for existing jobs, providing education and training for jobs in the future, and then specifically assisting businesses as their workforce develops. Customized employee training is a key role for us at Chemeketa. We had about 10,000 students in a single year in hundreds of classes in these customized training programs for specific businesses, Monrovia Nursery, Fuentes Brothers, a whole list of specific businesses. An earlier slide, I think, showed some of the figures from Chemeketa's work with AgriFrozen, but again, at Chemeketa and other community colleges, we have worked hard to assist dislocated workers and thus assist our local economies. And again, we this one college has helped thousands of displaced workers, working with over 40 different businesses responding to layoffs in business and industry. And again, this is critical work that if we don't do it, it doesn't get done. So that would be my overall picture. So I ask you to imagine a very diverse community college working with lower division transfer, professional technical programs, and many other members of the community and businesses in the community to improve the quality of life.
And with that, I'm going to talk a little bit about the community college governance and finance system. Each community college is governed by a locally elected 7-member board. And this really is one of the strengths of community colleges, in that That board is, because they are elected on a local level, they're very in tune with their community needs. The local board is responsible not only for hiring and supervising the president of each community college, but they also adopt each community college budget. And so they're very in tune with the needs of their local community. And you'll see that reflected in that each of our colleges has a different programs that they offer, different emphasis on different types of programs, depending on what that individual community need is. There's also a state agency, Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, of which CAM is the head of. And that is the agency that distributes the money that's received from the state general fund out to each of the community colleges. And I also wanted to mention the Oregon Community College Association, which is the association of all 17 colleges, which provides the advocacy and services to colleges. Funding for community colleges really comes from three primary sources. It's the state general fund, local property taxes, and tuition and fees from the students. And we have two charts here. I wanted to point out on the left-hand side is pre-Measure 5 funding, where you can see the bulk of the money came from local property taxes. At that time, it was 47%. And 28% of the funding came from the state general fund. With the passage of Measure 5, that really has shifted, where in the 0103 biennium, 53% of the funding for community colleges did come from the state general fund, and 21% from local property taxes. You can see that the tuition and fees has remained somewhat the same, though I would say that when we get the figures done for at the end of this biennium and going into this next biennium, the amount that's being financed by tuition and fees is increasing because of the rapid increase in tuition that colleges have put in place this year. And the other part on that would be federal funds or grant funding that comes in for the community college. Community colleges is a good investment in Oregon. We have a economic report that was done that shows that Oregon taxpayers receive a 17% return on their investment for their money that they put into community colleges, and that for every full year that a student completes, they will earn an additional over $3,600 per year in income that they receive from their 1 year spent in community college. With tuition and fees for community colleges, currently the average cost for a student to attend full-time for 1 year is $2,200. This is set by the local college board, so that you'll see an array of tuition costs depending on which college that the student will attend, because that is a local decision, and each local board will look at their local economy and their local student needs to try to come up with the right balance between the tuition costs students can afford, but also what money do they need to offer the programs that students need to maintain access for students. As I mentioned before, tuition has increased dramatically this year, 12% just in this year alone, and with some of our colleges increasing tuition as high as 25% this year. And overall, it's been an increase.
Excuse me, yes. Representative Dalton?
Oh, I apologize. I thought you were going on to the other side. My question is this. The tuition for a student, paying their component is $2,200. Do you have a sense of what the actual cost is overall, when you include the general fund and property tax components of an actual tuition? And I don't know if that's per credit or for the whole system. I went to a four-year school, so I'm not really sure how you break it down. But do we know what the actual cost is providing that education?
Chair Backman, Representative Dalto, we actually did some work on this prior to the last legislative session and developed CCWD, the state agency, developed a funding model that took information from IPEDS, which I apologize, I can't remember exactly what it stands for, but it's a national reporting system that looks at the actual cost to provide an education. And based on the figures from there, and I apologize, I don't have the figures with me, but we can estimate the actual cost per FTE, which is a full-time equivalent. So it wouldn't be exactly per each student, but for an average full-time student, what the cost would be. I know that last session it was somewhere around $5,000, but I will get those actual figures for you. The figures here, the tuition and fees, is just the amount that the students pay out of pocket for that.
Mr. Chair, I suppose I'd be interested to know that number for the community colleges and the four-year public university. Thank you.
And just a follow-up to that as well, It does look at the average cost, but depending on what type of program a student is in, the cost to offer that program vary greatly. For example, lower division transfer is going to be at a much lower cost. The professional technical programs in our colleges are extremely expensive to offer. And for example, a nursing program that is a two-year program that educates students to be become registered nurses at the end of the program can cost anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000 per student to offer that. So they are very expensive to offer and have a smaller amount of students enrolled in those.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. So so are those courses, like nursing courses, commensurately more expensive on a tuition level if they're more expensive to offer?
Chair Backlund, Representative Dalto, at each of the community colleges, the students pay the same tuition, and it's on a per-credit hour basis. At some colleges, they may have fees associated with certain programs, perhaps a lab fee or other fees. But again, that will vary per college fees. But generally, it is the same tuition, regardless of the type of class that you are taking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. As you can see on this slide, the cost in Oregon is higher than our neighboring states, particularly California, which has a very heavily state-subsidized community college system. I believe that their tuition has been $11 per credit hour, and they're now talking about doubling it to $22 per credit hour. So it's quite a bit different than the other system. For our students, one of the ways to help them finance their community college education is through grants and loans. Oregon has the Opportunity Grant, which is the only state-supported need-based financial aid program for students. And many of our students at our colleges are recipients of this grant. Though I will point out, it's only available for those students that are full-time students. Community colleges have a very high proportion of part-time students because many of our students are older, they have jobs, they have families, and they come in and they take classes when they can. For those students, they are not eligible to receive the opportunity grant. So this is only available for those who are full-time students. The average amount for each community college in the 2002-03 year was $743. And this also gives you some indication on the average household income for students that are receiving the grant. For those students, however, though, we did want to point out that there's 13,000 students that were eligible this last year that did not receive the grant because of a lack of funding. And so those are all that qualified based on need but weren't able to actually receive any money. And the grant currently covers 10% of the cost of education for a community college student. So if you're interested in looking at those numbers for your individual districts, it shows you the number of students that were eligible for the grant last year and those who did not receive the funding. And then I also wanted to mention a little bit about the current budget for community colleges as proposed by the governor's budget. Community colleges, last legislative session for the 0103, received $462 million into the support fund, which is distributed out to the 17 community colleges. As of the fifth special session, that number was $440 million, and those distributed out to the colleges. And the number proposed in the governor's budget for this year is $407 million to be distributed out to community colleges.
Andrew, you're talking about the 03-05?
Right. The last number for the governor's balanced budget would be 03-05.
Excuse me.
So for each of our colleges, they're looking at how to close the gap, either through decreasing programs, decreasing course offerings, and increasing tuition to try to meet the needs of their local communities. With that, we'd be happy to answer any questions that you would like. If you have other questions in the future, we have our names and our phone numbers on here, so feel free to contact us with any specific questions that you may have. We'd be happy to answer your questions.
Andrew, you didn't mention Measure 28. For this biennium, could you comment on the impact of Measure 28 for the remainder of 0103?
Chair Backlund, members of the committee, for Measure 28, there's $14 million that community colleges will gain if Measure 28 passes. For our colleges, many of them have placed steps in place to deal with the loss of the $14 million simply because at this point in their year, all they would have left is spring term and they couldn't make that level of cuts. And so our colleges starting in the fall of this year started preparing for potential cuts of that $14 million. Specifically in raising tuition, many of our colleges had mid-year tuition increases. And also, many of the colleges in the past have added courses as students need them. For example, if they're offering Writing 121 or math courses, as courses fill up, colleges have added additional sections to meet the needs of the students. Many of our colleges starting in fall term and continuing into winter term did not add additional sections in order to save money and basically let students know that it really was a first-come, first-served basis, and the students needed to try to get into the courses they needed because there would not be additional ones added. And so that has had an impact on students, that colleges have started early to plan for potential cuts and are obviously hopeful that that they can get some additional funding if Measure 28 does pass.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate hearing about our community colleges, and we appreciate your coming to present that to us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we'll hear next presentation about the Oregon University System. And we see a number of folks here from the OUS.
You should be complimenting me.
Please begin, Chancellor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Richard Jarvis. I am the nearly new Chancellor of the Oregon University System. And I say nearly new because I've been here now since last August. And I'd like to open by just taking a moment to let you know this is my first moment in front of you as a legislative assembly, or indeed any meeting of the state legislature. And I'm very pleased and proud to represent the system that I now have the privilege to lead. In my own history, I've spent time as the Chancellor of the University and Community College System of Nevada, and I've been the Chief Academic Officer of the State University of New York. I am very proud and very pleased to be here in Oregon. I'm working with an excellent group of universities, a group of presidents, and a group of faculty that I'm very proud to represent. So just to let you know that it is indeed a pleasure for all of the difficulties we struggle with to be here. Thank you. If I could take a little bit of your time this afternoon with a presentation on where we stand in the university system and lead you through some background and some of the issues that we would like to focus on in the course of today's presentation. And certainly, obviously, please feel free to interrupt me and direct any questions in any way in which you would wish, and I'll try and move this right along. Let's see. We titled this the crunch time, and we feel it a bit of a crunch. But let me say at the beginning that we are a fine university system. You have built in this state a university system to be proud of. I am here to report to you that our students, we have never had more students than we have today. We've never had a finer student body than we have today. And we've never had a finer faculty complement than we have today. But we need your help. So I'm here to say, take pride and pleasure in what we have accomplished, but help us keep it that way, and we look forward to working that relationship through. We feel we're at a bit of a crunch. We're facing rising enrollments. We're facing declining state support. We understand the reasons for that. We're also, our students are facing declining financial aid, and they are severely stressed, and we have a substantial deferred maintenance backlog. The result is our primary threat right now is to the quality of this system and the risks that it faces as we look at the future. I'm going to show you this graph a couple of times, if I may, and it's our enrollment history over the last 10 to 12 years. And it really tells you two stories. It tells you in the first part of the 1990s the tremendous crash that we took after the passage of Measure 5, and it took a long time for us to recover that plateau in enrollment. There's not another university system in the country that would show that length of time with no increase, in fact, a decrease in its university enrollment, certainly in the 1990s. So there is a missing generation of Oregonians who did not get into our universities during that time period. As you can see, since 1998, we've been on quite a trajectory of growth, and we're projecting that onwards through the rest of this decade, and in fact, as I'll return to this graph a little later on, we think it's going to increase even faster than the current projections that we have, and I'll speak to that, what might happen by 2010 question when I get to it. So clearly, two stories in our past of severe limitation and substantial growth. While that's happening, our state support has dwindled, and you're obviously much more familiar than I am with the good reasons for that, and we have had to manage with a dwindling proportion of the state budget. And that has been a concern for our presidents and has led to some of the requests that you'll see during the course of this presentation. But before I talk about institutions and presidents, let me reiterate a little bit of what you just heard from my colleagues in the community colleges, and that is the pressure on the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And forgive me, I'm a slide behind. A pressure on the Oregon Opportunity Grant. We're looking at the last several years from 1998-99 onwards. We see that the number of eligible recipients for the grant has climbed steadily, but those who have actually received awards has remained pretty flat. So we're going to be looking this year at something like 54,000 eligibles and only 21,000, almost 21,000 recipients. That bites very, very hard at the four-year schools because obviously our tuition is higher, and that is a point where students then have a very large gap to make up from other fund sources. So the Opportunity Grant is a major problem for us. It presently provides only 10% of the total cost of attendance, down from 11% last year. That's been dwindling at a time of economic stress. And the target level for support, if the initiative proposed by the Opportunity Grant Coalition, in which we're a member, everybody, all the other institutions and all the student groups are a member, if that coalition initiative is successful, it is targeting to reach 15% of the total cost of attendance. So we're looking at continued long-term pressure on our students to make up a substantial portion of their costs of going to college.
Mr. Chancellor?
Yes, sir.
A question. I've gone to quite a number of high school with high school parent night and seniors meeting with college attendance people, not attendance people, but admissions people. And it used to be said that if a student was capable of doing college work, could get into the university, even though he or she didn't have much in the way of financial resources, somehow there would be support for that student to enroll. Is that still true?
Mr. Chairman, I think that statement is only true with a substantial amount of debt burden.
Mm-hmm. Loans, you're saying.
Loans. Mm-hmm. And that is indeed the challenge that we provide. In many cases, we're able to say, yes, we can provide a financial aid package, but it's a financial aid package in which the vast majority of support is being made up through loans. Mm-hmm. Our students now graduate with a higher debt burden on average than the national average. And that's very shocking for a Western state where traditionally tuition rates have been rather low. So that is indeed a challenge for us. Just to continue and put that in a little bit of context, and perhaps make rather a pointed comparison, we've not kept up with our neighbors. And although I'm new to this state, I must tell you, I recognize it is not wise to make comparisons with those wussy states back east, so I'm simply looking to the north and saying, take a look at some hard numbers for our students to bear. Obviously, we have a lower population in the state of Washington, but looking at the ratios there, we can see that we're offering something under 19,000 need grants compared to 50,000 up north. Our ratio of support against our tuition in the public four-year sector, we're covering about a third of the cost of going to college for a student. In Washington, that's almost complete coverage. Our funding this next year, $18 million, bears over $100 million. We have no work-study program, and our average award, something under 90%, substantially under theirs. So this truly is a challenge for us in an environment in which our competitor states are indeed managing to get to this, and it's something that we want to contribute to as well as urge your support for.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Farr.
Thank you. Comparing Oregon to Washington schools, do Washington colleges have other sources of income, enterprise sources of income?
Representative Farr and Chairman Backlund, I'm sure they do, as indeed do ours. Yeah. And all schools today see as a major part of their responsibility private fundraising to provide scholarship support. And we're working very hard. Our presidents are out working very hard on that, too. The challenge becomes in the public sector so often, the sense among the public, well, that's what we pay our state support for, and so it's harder to get that kind of scholarship support in the public sector. I'm sure we're working as hard as the Washington schools are to make that up. Again, when the Washington schools cover 94% of the cost of tuition, that's not the cost of college, that's the cost of tuition. There's still another $6,000 to $8,000 of books and accommodation and support. So still a long way to go to actually get someone through a year of these institutions.
Follow up, please.
So
some of the money that is raised by, for instance, the University of Oregon through its investments is some of that money spent on grants as well as money that's awarded by the legislature?
Chairman Buckley, Representative Farr, yes, indeed. The challenge for the institutions is, of course, that they are not only providing need-based scholarship support, which is what we've been looking at in the opportunity grant, mm-hmm. but they also have a deal of merit-based awards and a number of other awards that they use to fill out the elements of the student body they're seeking to acquire. So there are other demands upon fee remissions from the institutions. I was focusing this as an attention on the need-based piece of it, and that's the one that's sort of gotten away from us a bit, I think.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Chancellor Jarvis, I'm drawn to the last line on this chart, and I can't do the precise arithmetic very quickly, but 94%, $1,800 is 94% of tuition in Washington. That tells me that tuition there is south of $2,000. Whereas $1,000 is a third of ours, that says our tuition is north of $3,000. Can you address the issue of accessibility, not just to the students who are eligible to the needs grant, but that those numbers tell me that we are much more inaccessible to students who aren't eligible for the needs grant?
Chairman Beckland, Representative Nolan, yes, indeed. We have led the West in tuition for quite some time, and we're continuing to backfill our reductions in state support with increases in tuition. So our tuition rates are substantially high for Western State, and you're seeing that in those numbers. There are a number of other ways in which we're denying access that I'll touch on later, but your point is well made, that for many students who would not consider consider themselves, or whose families would not consider themselves to be needy students, they are in fact undergoing a very high financial pressure. What that leads to is a very high level of student employment. And we know there are all kinds of research studies will show that the more students work beyond a certain minimum amount, the more those employment hours go up, then unfortunately the impact on academic performance starts to kick in. So we are pressing our students on a number of dimensions through this support measure. And that would come in for students who are not falling into this category too. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Parr.
Thank you. I heard anecdotally that the cost of education in the Oregon system for out-of-state students is, quite a bargain, and that's why so many students do choose to come to Oregon from out-of-state. Is that a true statement?
Chairman Backlund, Representative Farr, we intend to make it quite a value, but certainly not a bargain. I think we've been working pretty hard to find the level the market will bear for our out-of-state students. So we are clearly on a tuition strategy which uses out-of-state tuition to provide surplus funds for supporting the rest of our enterprise. So I think the pattern of tuition increases in recent years has been to push the out-of-state tuition as much as we can to find what the market will bear, recognizing we're now in a competitive arena where all states are competing for out-of-state students because they're all experiencing what we are, and so we do want to keep the enrollment up and that revenue coming in.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Bakian.
Chancellor, converse to that, I've also heard that it's less expensive for some of our students to pay out-of-state tuition in other states than it is to pay in-state tuition in Oregon. Have you heard of any of that, and if so, do you have any figures regarding the tuition in other states?
Chairman Backlund, Representative Bavakian, let me get back to you, if I may, on numbers on that. I guess I'd be rather surprised in that most every state I'm aware of has been substantially increasing out-of-state tuition in order to generate revenues. So we're at a level of $3,800 to $4,500 per year tuition. I can't imagine there are states who are charging less than that for in-state tuition, but I will check that up and get those figures back to you. If I could then switch a topic and move from the personally stressful one of student financial aid to the physically stressful one of infrastructural financial aid. We're also looking at some serious maintenance and replacement problems. We've been deferring maintenance for a long time, and I put these together because, in fact, what we've done in the last decade is try to keep the student enrollment up by continuing to defer maintenance. So we're reaching a point now where, as that goes on, stress levels are getting somewhat alarming. About half of our buildings are between 25 and 40 years old, and so they're reaching that point where they need attention. Subsystems need looking at. Buildings and systems tend to go together, and so we estimate that we currently have a system replacement backlog of the order of $500 million, and that then becomes a major part of our presentation and our request this year. About half of our facilities constructed within that 60 to 75 time period, so we've got the consequences of those very good years now coming back by way of severe maintenance stress. The question then that I would like to leave with you, if I may, today and spend the rest of our time talking about here is that of holding the line on quality, because that is our greatest concern. And at this point, I'll attempt my one effort at mild humor for today. And then this is to indicate this is what happens when people are running real hard, but unfortunately with blinders on. And we've been running real hard for a long time. What happens then is sometimes you don't see some of the consequences of well-meaning, well-intended other actions, but they can lead you to a high pace and then a sudden fall. And at the moment, we're feeling that sense of a lot of surrounding air and looking for a bit of worry. We know gravity works, and we're a little concerned about what might lie at the bottom of all of that. We do understand that in these days, above all, accountability is going to be paramount in your minds, and it's very much paramount in our minds. We feel that we've got a strong record on performance measurement, and we take that very seriously within this system. And I can tell you, among other systems that I've been familiar with, we take it much more seriously than most states. We've got a good history in SB 271 of setting efficiency as a key standard for us, of developing goals in SB 919, and of developing the appropriate performance measures out of that. The board has approved four sets of goals for us: to expand access for students statewide, to strengthen the quality of our programs, to enhance the employability of our graduates because we know they are the core of our future, and to achieve cost effectiveness. And for each of those, we have a set of quantitative performance measures which we capture each year and on which we base our evaluations of ourselves, our institutions, and our leaders. The ones that I would draw your attention to just for the sake of this presentation and its emphasis on quality are those under the quality heading. And we monitor very carefully our freshman persistence, to what extent are we successful in keeping new students in our universities, our completion rate for undergraduates, the satisfaction of those graduates, and there were recent newspaper stories, in fact, of the success of our graduates in getting the jobs they were looking for, the revenues we're able to bring in, because we do believe that folks who have the opportunity to invest private resources in our institutions invest where they see quality and where they're impressed, our ability to generate gifts, grants, and contracts, and our ability to maintain competitive compensation for our faculty and for our staff, and I would emphasize faculty and staff. Those are measures that we take seriously, and I'd be happy to spend more time at another time on the trends in each of those. I can tell you that our measures are high and our measures are improving. But we are reaching a tip point where at this stage we cannot continue to do that without some further help. So we are proud to serve this state. We presently reach over 1 million Oregonians each year in one form or another through teaching, research, and service. We are a growing system. Our enrollment has grown by 14,000 over the last decade, and I would suggest that we will continue to grow. We would like to continue to grow, and Oregonians should want us to continue to grow for the remainder of this decade at rates in excess of that. When we talk about a knowledge-driven economy, that's what universities do. We are at the core of that economy. We provide over $250 million. The faculty in our universities bring into the state over $250 million in sponsored research, and that generates both opportunities for our students, new knowledge for our faculty, and our institutions, and jobs as those funds are spent within the state. And we can report high levels of both student satisfaction and employer satisfaction, and we take a lot of trouble in surveying graduates and surveying their employers and asking, are they happy with the school they chose? Are they happy with the skills that they gave? And we get measures in excess of 70% satisfied or highly satisfied, both from students and from employers. We are a large and diverse system. We have 7 universities, 1 new branch campus in Bend, 143 sites where teaching takes place across the state. So we are wherever Oregonians are, and we are pleased and proud of that. Let me go back to that enrollment graph, if I may, now. As we look forward from today's 78,000 students in the middle of that graph and say, well, where do you think we'll be? If we continue to project at the rates at which we have been recruiting students out of our high schools, out of our community colleges, and returning students, and we simply do the arithmetic of continuing those trends, then we would reach a level of about 93,000 students by the year 2010. If, however, we look at what we think are the real demand drivers in our economy, we believe that rate of increase in demand now, will in fact be substantially higher than 93,000 and closer to 100,000 by the year 2010. And if I could illustrate what I mean by that on the next page. The traditional drivers that we model our recruitments on are what I would call pipeline drivers. They're the graduates coming out of high school, the rate at which those students continue on to college within a year or so of graduation. They're the transfers primarily from our community colleges and also from other schools, both in-state and returning to the state. And I would suggest to you that there's a healthily growing pipeline in the field of master's education. As more and more students progress through to bachelor's degrees, more and more bachelor's degree students start to come back for master's credentialing. All of those we have a pretty good handle on, and those are the lines that we've been recruiting and enrolling for some time. I would suggest to you that it's in the right-hand column where we see tremendous other opportunities and needs among Oregonians that four-year schools have traditionally not focused on quite as much as perhaps we should do, and I would suggest as we need to in the knowledge economy. When we look at our students coming to our campuses now, we see that approximately a fifth or so of that freshman class will not be there for the second year of their education. And those are very normal figures for four-year schools across the country. What happens to those students and why are they not there for the second year? In a very few cases, it is a matter of academic shortcomings. The students go off and get training somewhere else or find that university or college is not for them. But in the vast majority of freshman attrition, it is a matter of life got in the way, a relationship got in the way, and usually what drove those factors is money. So we are looking at situations in which students drop out to improve their earnings, fix something in their life that needs fixed, and almost always that has something to do with money. Think of that population then as one in five of our freshmen each year, this year, next year, and next year after that, through their 20s, through their 30s. That's a population of Oregonians out there that I would suggest to you are college ready, we know because they started with us, value the idea of a bachelor's degree, and for whom the benefits that that bachelor's degree will bring are just as important as they are to the 18-year-old coming out of high school. So that means the reentrance coming back from a period of caregiving or work. That means career change professionals. That means professional development for folks who are looking to upgrade their skills. That means indeed the lifelong learners. And I give them a little nickname in my own mind of the broken bachelors, the folks out there who've got part of a degree and to whom we would like to reach out and provide more capacity. If we look at the proportion of Oregonians who fall in that category and say, well, if we could reach out to as many of them as the most aggressive states do, that's when we hit a demand factor of about 100,000 students by 2010. And that's a population that we're largely going to miss at the present time. We're not going to be able to reach them. Here's what's happened to us in the 90s and in the last couple of years. In the course of the 1990s, thanks to good efforts in tough times, our appropriations, in fact, went up 21% in dollar figures. When we offset that against the cost of doing business with inflation, it shows a 4-point drop at a time when we took an almost 10% increase in enrollment. I think that's within the range of productivity increases. We can look at the 90s and say we got through that, we were able to show more efficiencies, take more students, and manage that within the revenues that we got. Compare a decade of funding and enrollment change with just 2 years of funding and enrollment change. And in the last 2 years since the last regular session of the legislature, our funding has dropped, offset against inflation by about 5 points, and our enrollment's up by about 11 points. That's a stress level that we can't accommodate with productivity increases. So we are feeling severely stressed, and I'm suggesting that the place that comes home to roost is in the quality area. We are funded according to a model called the Resource Allocation Model, or RAM, that came in 1999. And it provided, and still does, a new way of our doing business. And we're very grateful for that model. I think it was a substantial step forward for the system and for the state. It encourages entrepreneurial activity and business standards in our institutions, and it makes clear the funding follows the student. There's a clear consequence for growing institutions, providing more access for Oregonians. This is higher ed, so it is indeed, of course, a complex model with lots of boxes and labels. But what we're distinguishing are a whole set of activities in which we, the campuses, generate revenue through tuition and fees, through our research and sponsored programs, through our auxiliary enterprises, and through gifts and grants from those areas in which you appropriate state tax funds for per-student support and for the various lump sum programs on the right-hand side. The important characteristics I would emphasize just in the middle of the graph, it's a student-centered model, it's understandable, it holds us accountable, everybody knows what they're buying, and there are a limited number of allocation elements. So it gives us, as close as we can get, a transparent and accountable way of doing business. It relates us, interestingly, to a group of peers. And I put these names up here just to remind ourselves what it is we're trying to emulate and the standards we're trying to follow. And perhaps the easiest way to get a quick handle on a great deal of information is just look at the middle box that covers the largest number of students and our large universities. And we could just as well do this for any of the regional universities or for the Oregon Institute of Technology. But let me just take that middle box for an example. That's saying that when we look at the institutions against whose performance we wish to be judged and whose performance we are seeking to match, we're looking at places like Arizona, Cal Davis, Iowa State, Purdue, North Carolina State, Illinois, Chicago, and so on. Those are the peers that we measure ourselves against in our performance measures and whose funding we look at to see if we're able to match them for efficiencies and so on. As a result, the funding of those institutions then provides a measure of how they're supported and how they're able to achieve what it is they do. We use the average funding in this RAM model, this resource allocation model, to provide for us a quality funding index. It's not a measure of quality itself, it's a measure of the funding provided by these institutions that drives their quality for the relationship between enrollment and funding. And that's going to be our challenge, more enrollment than we can handle and a stress on funding. In order to capture it in a single number, we express the number as the percentage by which our funding falls below the average for our peers. How far are we below the average for our peers? Not the highest of our peers, which we know are very well funded, and certainly not the lowest of our peers. How do we compare against the average funding for those peers? And what we would ask you to consider, and our proposal is, that we try and come to an agreement on what an appropriate minimum is there. How far below the average support for our peers dare we go before we put our quality seriously and permanently at risk? And we're proposing 20% below as a stress level that we would like to establish and work back from. In coming up with our proposal for this year, we've tried to, in fact, rethink the way we ask you for resources. And we've taken a step that I could never imagine myself taking in a career in higher education, and that is to back off and reduce our request and say we recognize the straitened circumstances in which the state is placed. We can't aspire to full funding of this model, funding at the average right now. In fact, as we look out through the next several years, we don't think we can get there for three biennia. So we'd like to say, let's establish a floor at 20% below the median of our peers, and let's try and work back from that over the course of the next three biennia. Let's establish an intent to approach back towards that average. So in our best request now, we would be saying to you, can we get back to within 10% of the median? Now, why do we say 10%? Well, here's our history. Back in 1999, when the RAM came in, we had a substantial increase in legislation, what everybody now refers to as the good old days. At that point, when the RAM was introduced, we stood at 11 points below the median of our peers and held that through the 2000 and 2001 biennium. We are presently about 25 points, given the current circumstances in this biennium, about 25 points below the average, and if Measure 28 should fail tomorrow, that would drop us about another 3 points to 28 points below. Were we to continue our current funding into the next biennium and attempt to take all of the students that we project will apply, then at that point, we would be falling some 35 points below the median of our peer funding. And at that point, I would have to tell you that we would be a fourth tier system attempting to compete with these other peer institutions around the country. That's the challenge for us as we attempt to match a very competitive arena. So we look at the place we're in.
Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before you leave that one, Chancellor, in K-12 education, there's a variety of factors that go into the comparison of per pupil spending across the country, and it's really a mishmash of comparing all kinds of things. In determining the median here, are the universities using, are you comparing apples and apples to a greater extent, so that when you're figuring out the median, the same factors are going into it for all of the universities that you're comparing?
Chair Backlund, Representative Hobson, yes, I believe we are. It is a consistent set of comparisons with that set of peers. Now, we're looking, we're focusing here on a whole range of disciplines, a whole range of student levels. All of those are factored into the model. And we're comparing both the effect of the tuition contribution and the state contribution. So when we look at these, we're trying to say, how do we then compare to these peers, to which the group we believe, and we believe Oregon has believed, we should belong. And our concern is that as we drop below that, substantially below that, we reach a point where, in fact, there are really no longer peers. It's a club we don't belong to anymore. We're looking at from too far out on the highway. So I believe they are a comparable set of peers. It drops us down to another place where there would be other institutions in this country that are good institutions, but that would not be within the categories that you saw for all of our institutions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I think I might have skipped on. If I can get back, if I may. Then, so the summary in all of this is it's a picture that you can imagine for a while. We are certainly seeing increasing enrollment, increasing demand for baccalaureate and beyond education at a time of diminishing support compared to those peers with whom we compete for faculty, we compete for students, and we compete for research grants. And that's what drives so much of the arena in which we have to operate. It is a nationally competitive arena, and that's where we go to get that $250 million of research. That's where we go to get the top faculty, and that's where our students both come from and go to. So we want very much to stay within that group of peers and have them see us as part of them. But you asked a question, Chair Backlund, about were students able to come to our institutions? Was access being provided? And I think that is very much the question of the day for us. And I'd elaborate on a little bit, if I may, in this slide, which is that as support dwindles, we in fact deny access in a number of ways, the most obvious of which is to say, well, those students who are financially needy and who do not receive an opportunity grant, that's an obvious denial of access. It's easy to understand that they would not be able to overcome the financial burdens of coming to college. That's the one that's in all of our minds. There are a number of other denials of access that don't quite leap out at you so readily. For most part-time students, there is no financial aid. And that's all of those students seeking to come back and upskill and return to learning. Financial aid programs, by and large, are not targeted to them. And so for many of them, unless they can afford to generate the results, the finances themselves, then they won't even bother to apply. And so we will never record them as wishing to enter and being denied. They're an invisible denial of access. For students who are loan averse, and that applies particularly to students from families who would be the first generation to college, for them the kind of debt burdens that our graduates are now being asked to bear seem very threatening. And for many of them, that is simply a message, do not bother to apply. Incidentally, it also becomes a message for students within our institutions for whom the choice of major and program then becomes in part a loan debt problem. And for many of those, we're looking at students who would like to go into important human service professions and public service professions, teaching, nursing, etc., for whom the debt burden and repayment of that debt burden becomes a substantial denial of access. And I often say it's easy to think of denying access in terms of those who can't get in. I also think of those who are in and can't get out, who are in and for whom the access to courses, to completing their program on time, to being able to get into a section of reasonable size is not available. And that's the stress that's also proving really difficult for us at the moment. So we're seeing longer time to degree, students having to work more, less able to get into classes, and that stretches out the cost to the student who's got to spend another year in school, and to us as citizens, because we don't get a benefit of their having completed their program and getting on out into the workforce and realizing the benefits that they wanted. So access denied becomes a complicated picture. We have been turning to our students a lot, and you can see the steady picture of tuition increases over the last two decades. Our tuition is now ranging from somewhere in the 3,600 range to about the 4,400 range, and we are looking at steady increases. That's full-time undergraduate for a year, just tuition, we're looking at steady and multiple increases as we've gone through this year. As a result, in the last national survey conducted by the National Center for Public Policy in Higher Education, which looks at states, not at institutions or systems, but states as a whole, and says, how affordable are you? And again, my colleagues in the community colleges mentioned this. How affordable are we in Oregon providing post-secondary education? I'm afraid we didn't do very well. We ended up in the West with a company that I'd like to see us move up that chart. What that's telling us is that the burden of a college education in relationship to family income is higher here than just about anywhere in the West, bar Montana. So that's the F in affordability that you heard about in the newspapers in the fall, and that's the stress that we're feeling and how we can deal with this and why aid becomes such an important factor for us. So what can we do about this, and how can we address these challenges? The access, more students want to get in than we've ever seen. Quality, we want to maintain and continue our improvement. Affordability, severely under stress, and maintenance of our capital assets. And so we've come up with an approach and a title to get some attention, which we suggested: could we make a new deal? Could we come up with a new way of approaching this and establish a new partnership with you and with the state, where the state buys in, the system buys in, and as important, our students buy in. We can't get from where we are to where we'd like to be and where we hope you would like to be within the next biennium. In fact, we don't think we can get there for anything less than 3 biennia. So we are as interested this session in your long-term commitment and support, and statements of intent are worth a very great deal to a system that has been under the restrictions that we have. That creates a partnership instead of an argument. That allows us both to tackle this conundrum, this challenge of both access and quality, so that we don't get into the situation where you become the champions of access and say it's important you take every qualified student, and we become the whiners about quality, saying, yeah, but if we do, then we're gonna have to stress our institutions to a lower level than they should go. Can we approach that together and understand that there is a relationship there that we would like to set and reset with you? We see that there are 3 pieces that need to come together for this. There needs to be a set of state understandings, there needs to be equally important a set of student tuition understandings, and when both of those are said and done, they won't provide enough resources. We need to close that gap. We, the institutions and the system, need to close that gap and be more efficient and more entrepreneurial. So what we're looking for is an intent to define a quality level and to improve it. A recognition on the state's part that research is important, and I'll say a couple more points about that in a second. But we have to have our students understand that what we're asking of them is a fair share. We are asking of them high tuition indeed, and increasing tuition. But we must explain that we believe this is a fair share for resident undergraduates, and for everybody else, good value and not a bargain. To pick up on the earlier question, that tuition increases will, regrettably, but in fact be a continuing feature of our future. Can we make them at least predictable?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Avakian.
I wonder if you could be a little more specific on that part. You used the term fair share with regard to students, which is a qualitative,
yes,
I guess, analogy. And I wonder if you could talk a little more specifically about what that means and why you think it's a fair share.
Chairman Backlund, Representative Avakian, yes, I'd be happy to. What we're trying to establish is the relationship between the state contribution and the student contribution for resident undergraduates. I want to emphasize I'm talking about resident undergraduates only. And we're asking that the state contribution remain at least 50% of that total education and general support. So the state remains the senior partner, however narrowly, in that relationship. We are pushing up against that balance right now to a very troubling degree. And we believe it is really important for the state to make that investment in public education that does not ask the students always to have to backfill to the point that they become the majority providers in their own education for undergraduates. I would tell you that at the present time, for the system as a whole, we are looking at a ratio of about 53% state support to 47% student support for resident undergraduates. So we're getting awfully close to what I would regard as becoming an unfair share to ask of the students.
Mr. Chair, follow-up? And I think the last part of what you said maybe would have answered my question. You would, in an ideal situation, want the state to be supplying more than the percentage that you've got there, thereby making it a fairer share on the student tuition side. Isn't that right?
Representative Backley, Chairman Backley, yes, I would like to see a rate that is more comparable to our other peer states in the West. We've fallen rather below that. And so I'm looking at that 50-50 limit and saying that's a major threshold to go over. Let's not go there.
Thank you.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess do I understand that the actual cost of the education that we're providing, the tuition is about half of what the actual picture is, and the state is providing another half, so I can take what the tuition is and double it and come up with an approximation of what the actual instruction costs?
For resident undergraduates only, yes, sir. Representative Dalton, Mr. Chairman Backlund, yes, that would be a correct interpretation.
Thank you.
Now, I'm sorry, if I could just elaborate perhaps just a little bit further. That is an education in general cost. That is not looking to spread the other costs of the university onto this group of students. So we'd be just looking at providing those costs, targeting that group. For the other groups of students, we would look to recover a higher proportion from the student than that. So what we would be hoping for then is that if we could strike this kind of partnership, which would require our institutions to, in a sense, back off and say, can we start from a floor and grow our students to accept a high and growing level of tuition? What can we do that would provide a return on investment in that? Because we're still seeking a substantial investment from the state. We've laid out a series of goals and of competitive performance measures that would argue that for higher levels of student success, of persistence and completion, and for higher levels of faculty accomplishment. We don't believe that we can ask you for increased support unless we can perform at a higher level and enable our students to perform at a higher level. We believe we'd keep our average cost below those exercised nationally, below average cost to the taxpayers of this state. We're not asking to get up to the median of our peers. We'll stay below that and close that gap difference in order to get on that upward trend again. We try to maintain a fair share of student investment and look for affordability by setting aside some of each tuition increase that we're asked of our students now for financial aid for the neediest students. And that means that indeed some students will be asked to pay tuition that will be used to assist other students. We believe that the opportunity grant is in such a parlous state, is so far below any reasonable level of student support, we have to do something, and it is the only other support that we can find. We believe that this state would want, the citizens of this state, would want a system that would have a capacity in some form, and that can be a mixture of on-campus, at a distance, in-person, online, of 100,000 student equivalents by the year 2010, but presently at 78,000. We believe in order to get to that we can and should double the level of research, funded research that we're able to achieve, and make our contributions to economic development through tech transfer, and we would indeed expand our university outreach and public service. So we've tried to lay out a set of goals and performance indicators, and I won't go through every line of this very busy table, that would give you quantitative measures of accountability to hold us to if we can embark upon a growth trajectory to reach those higher student numbers. But we would show both student success, faculty performance, and campus outreach into our communities, and we'll put those through into quantifiable, measurable indicators, as we have always done with our performance in the last several biennium. So what we look to do is to commit as a system to higher performance goals, to a fair share approach on tuition, and to ourselves maintaining that balance, to making tuition predictable so that we don't go through these vast swings of feast and famine, and that as when a student comes to us, they would know that they can see some pattern in the likely trend of tuition during the years that they will be with us. that we will continue to set aside some of our tuition funds for financial aid for the neediest students, and that's in addition to the opportunity grant because it can't get there on its own, and that we would moderate our funding requests and request below average funding for the next three biennia and bridge that gap through the efficiencies that we're proposing in our Efficiency Act. And that's a key part of this, is to turn that request that the President's made last summer for more flexibility, more autonomy, more decentralization, to turn that into a series of incentives which would empower these campuses to help bridge that gap and solve some of this problem. What we're seeking from the state is a sense of commitment and understanding, and we certainly fully understand that it's going to take a while to generate the resources to drive this home. But let's start a journey, and if it takes us a little longer, then at least we're on a journey together. The most critical thing we need to develop an understanding with you is that there is a base of quality which we mustn't go beneath. And if we fall beneath that base of quality against our national benchmarks, it will take a very, very long time to restore that. We suggest that we could start at 20% below our peer average, try and work our way up to 10% over the course of three biennia. We believe that's a pace against which we could grow and give you that better performance. That if you can help support us with additional management and fiscal flexibility for the State Board and the campuses, we can do this, and we'll continue to seek increased support from you for need-based financial aid and lend our support to those other requests you will have from the community colleges, the independent colleges, and all of the student associations for increased need-based financial aid. We can do that. We think we can give you, we know we can give you more than nationally competitive performance. You'll be getting performance measures that are above the national average for a cost that is below the national average. Fair share for students, margin of excellence on the institutions. And the final begging page, if we can seek your support for a renewed commitment to growth and access. And that's a tough thing to see at a time when we're in fact going to be limited. We are full right now. We're going to be severely limited in the next biennia, but let's at least make a commitment to reach the kind of capacity that we believe Oregonians need by the year 2010. Find that base of quality and invest in it. Build financial aid. Help us with the flexibility initiatives in the efficiency bill and support the bond program for deferred maintenance. And thank you for your patience in this overly long presentation.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Chancellor. We appreciate the depth, actually, very much of your report, and whether that's good or bad, it'll give us a lot to think about. And my question is that good for us to think? But I guess we'll have to deal with that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Dalton.
Chancellor, do we know what the total amount for the backlog is of deferred maintenance? Do we have an idea?
Chairman Backner, Representative Delta, the total amount is about $500 million, and we're seeking to get that through a bond sale package.
Thank you.
Across the campus.
Chancellor, could you switch gears and talk a little bit to us about the PASS admission system?
Chair Backland, only a very little, and this is a case where I'll plead a little bit of novelty and get back to you with more information and better preparation the next time. The PASS system is of course our way of attempting to align admission standards from graduations from high school with those of our institutions. We believe very strongly in this. I can tell you that in my own research, considering coming to the state of Oregon, this close relationship, an emerging close relationship between the schools and the universities was something which attracted me very much indeed. I would like to see students more successful. I believe that a college opportunity is among the greatest things that our country has achieved, and so for me, the loss of students who enter our colleges and then slip out again is the greatest loss of all. So the ability to ensure that what students take in high school accomplishes a set of competency standards that will enable them to succeed in college is what drives the PASS system. I'll be happy to try and get back to you with some specifics on extent and results, but as I've been briefed on the system, it seems to me to be a leading edge of the standards-based high school to college connections that I've seen, and in most states the ability to connect what the students bring in high school to their college is not as well developed as the PASS system is attempting to accomplish.
Representative Vakin, did you have a question? We were discussing beforehand?
You know, I don't have a question, but I would appreciate at some point having them come back with some more specific information about the PASS program, and with respect to what you said at the end there, that that maybe what we're seeing out of our schools now is inadequate in order for you to gauge. Well, maybe I didn't understand exactly what you said. Why don't you explain just a little bit of what you said in your last sentence there, and then when you come back, maybe some more specific information about the PASS program.
Thank you, Chairman Backlin, Representative Arakian. Yes, no, I did not mean to imply that what's coming out of our schools is inadequate. I think what PASS brings us is an attempt to better align the competencies that students will need in their first years of college with what they leave high school with. Okay. And I think that's a very important effort that I think is better developed in what I've seen of the PASS system than anything I've seen in other states. So,
sure. Follow up.
But you don't think that something exists right now in order to serve that function. Is that right?
Chairman Backlin, Representative Arakian, I'm not sure the extent to which current graduates are going through that system. I don't have a number. That's my challenge. I don't know how many students are completing this and going through it. I know the design of the system, but I'm afraid I don't have the numbers with me. So I'm trying to give a sense of support for the goals and the academic strengths of the program, but I couldn't tell you how many students are going through it is my ignorance. I apologize.
That's right. Next time.
Yeah, we would undoubtedly at some point in the future we would like to kind of delve into that in a bit more detail, and that way I think that would be good for us.
Indeed.
And, so we'll look forward to that.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, with that, again, we appreciate your presentation. We appreciate those of you in the audience who have participated as spectators. And with that, we will then close today's meeting.
Thanks.